Off the ball.
Rugby.
Sevens was for your early 20s.
Were you ever tempted?
Couldn't have thought of anything worse. First of all, my engine was not my strong point. It would have had to be in those very early years.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Right, I am delighted to say I'm in the home of Mr. David Hickey. The home of Mr. David Hickey and also Perro, your small dog, who's not so small at all, a bear of a 2-year-old dog.
He is, yeah. He's a German Shepherd, and he's a lifeline for me. He's really a personality extraordinaire.
There's no fear of anybody sneaking into this house, I'd say.
Absolutely not. Even my son sneaking in late at night, that's the worst thing.
We're out here in Balbriggan, and this is where you spent some of your childhood, right? This is very much home for
yes,
you.
Yes, oh yeah. North Country Dublin is where I'm from. And it's almost a separate county from South Country Dublin. This is all the wild up here. And a lot of South Country people wouldn't dream of crossing the river. But we know the beauty of this place is a special, special part of my heart anyway. I really love it, yeah.
It really is. We're looking out into the Irish Sea right here. And as you said a moment ago, you can see a lighthouse. You can see the Mourne Mountains as well up to the north.
The Mourne Mountains up north, and you can see Rochabill Lighthouse out here.
Right.
And there's a local saying that on a good day, you can see Rochabill. And on a bad day, you can see England.
Yeah, that's a good one for the week. That's in at Wales this weekend, England and the Six Nations in a couple of weeks. So this is where you grew up. It's interesting because I wasn't actually sure if this was home for you, just given I viewed your early years through the prism of GAA, or at least the information online.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had presumed that you had lived in and around Raheny or something like that, but that obviously wasn't the case.
No, Raheny was kind of an accident. We lived in Portmara for most of my upbringing. And there was no football in Portmara. Sylvester's wasn't very serious. And I went to school in Sutton, and Raheny was the nearest serious sub to that.
Right.
So that's how Raheny was, yeah.
And was it always GAA and a bit of rugby when you were growing up? Was that it? Did you play anything else?
GAA, hurling and football.
Yeah.
And rugby was an afterthought when I was in UCD, yeah.
When did you start playing rugby?
1973.
Right. And was that just because of the fact that you were a UCD student at the time and nobody was playing?
I was on the Dublin team from 1969, which was the first year I went into UCD to do medicine. And it had no profile among the UCD students.
Right.
So I was playing a third team in college, as they call them, so that they were playing at a higher level than I was playing senior football for Dublin. So I went to see a match. Now, I watched rugby and I knew about rugby. And I made a statement that in 6 weeks I would be on the first team in UCD. That this went right up their noses because, you know, they had been trying from childhood to get on the horrors team in UCD. Anyway, I gave it the 6 weeks and I made it. Much to their annoyance, I think. They never forgave me for it. But the standard GA was way ahead at the time, way ahead in terms of fitness, physicality, athleticism. The Irish rugby team wouldn't hold a candle for them.
But in that little bubble in South Dublin,
they... Yeah, it was the centre of the world. Centre of the world.
It's amazing, isn't it, how Dublin has changed? Isn't it? Even the rugby fans now have a great appreciation for what's happened.
It is, and it's funny, you have Brian Pullen involved in rugby management with Leinster. You have Nathan Darcy now involved with Leinster. Tevin McManaman.
Right.
Our great Tevin McManaman. You might remember him.
No, I've never heard of him.
Tevin the Kerry Killer, I remind you.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a psychologist now. So
yeah.
It is. The main transition, though, is when I was playing, Anthony O'Toole was the only South County guy on the Dublin team.
Right. Himself
and Sean Doherty, who was actually from Wicklow. Today, they're nearly all from the South County.
Yeah.
Tim McHugh, all the other big teams, Hula, and Michael Dallas' team.
Ballyboden.
Yeah. I presented medals to an under 21 team there last Christmas, 12 months. Ballantyre St. John's. They were formed in 1982 on the back of our 70s success in the heartland of Temple Old, rugby territory. They now have 4,500 members.
Oh my God.
4,500 members in the heart of South City Dublin.
It's an unbelievable success story. How Gaelic games managed to take hold in places that 50 years ago literally did not exist.
Well, I think the greatest legacy of our team was that we prevented Wimbledon FC locating to Dublin.
You prevented them? How so?
In 1974, there was no rugby in Dublin, there was no soccer in Dublin, and there was no daily football team worth following in Dublin.
Yeah.
And at the time, there was talk of the franchise. Dublin had a population, Dublin had sport mad supporters, and they had no team. They were going to provide Vinnie Jones and his fellow Welsh to play here on a weekly basis, every second week. And we prevented that. And I think that's the greatest service that Dublin team did to Ireland.
Yes, it's remarkable. And you think there was a direct correlation? People finally had something to believe in.
Absolutely. I mean, they had their Clifford End experience on the hill. And it was wild enough now in those days.
Yes.
It was rough enough too. But they forget their whole experience at home.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very good point. Just pivoting from that a little bit, just as a couple of different parts of your childhood and your early years that I'm interested in, was medicine always the way you were going to go down when you realised you were maybe academically bright and capable of achieving that?
Well, if it was academically bright, I would have done engineering.
Right.
Because my dad was an engineer, and you had to have honours maths to do engineering.
Okay.
And even though I did it in Irish, I think I got the 10% you get for doing it in Irish.
Right.
So my mom was a nurse, and she was always one on about surgery, actually, not medicine, surgery. So anyway, I went up to sign up, and the queue was shorter for medicine than it was for architecture or something.
Right.
So I hopped into that one.
Okay, very good.
So there was no way to, I wasn't a burning desire to save the world for medicine, no.
Okay. You did realise, I presume, when you start in UCD or maybe a couple of years afterwards, that you do have a gift for it. It wasn't just an athletic gift. Career-wise, you obviously are on the forefront of a fairly pioneering stage of transplant medicine. And
I'm a big believer in Albert Camus' statement that everything he learned in life about social responsibility and duty, he learned on the football field. Playing football, playing a team sport and being part of a team, and if you're looking to be part of a successful team, gives you far more than any MS, BS, PhD gives you. In terms of human interaction, responsibility, keeping your word, delivering your part, and working as a team. And I would say my education was playing daily football with Raheny and Dublin as much as it was in the medical school in UCD. And I will go further and say, I learned virtually nothing in medical school in UCD in terms of the humanity side of medicine.
Right.
It was a technical education.
The humanity side then?
Came from football.
Football alone?
Well, my mother and father, obviously, and my extended family were all kind of good people,
yeah.
Helpful people. But no, I mean, I would say I saw playing daily football in North Inner City, Dublin. You saw real poverty, and you saw incredible volunteerism on behalf of the people who looked after us.
Mm.
Brought us to matches, picked us up after matches, brought us to hospital if we were hurt. Unbelievable. All unpaid work. And the country owes them a great debt, I've seen.
Absolutely, especially pre Heffo's Army, pre the glamour.
Well, pre the glamour, and even, you know, after the Heffo's Army, as you call it, I mean, there was very little glamour in going from Raheny to Ballyfermot on a wet Sunday morning in December.
Right.
I can tell you. And the dads did it. And those fellows are my heroes, actually. Particularly a fellow called Brendan Lee in Portmarnock. He ran Raheny Football and Hurling Club almost as a one-man show.
Right.
For 20 or 30 years. Yeah.
The humanity aspect is really interesting because we do want to talk about what's happening now eventually, but just kind of rewinding to your own humanity and when you kind of realise that, when does that start to become a worldly sort of humanity? Was there moments in your childhood, moments that predate Cuba, for example, that you thought to yourself, I have a bigger role to play here?
Well, I think that then it's a bit of my upbringing. We grew up in Dublin in the 60s and everybody was poor. There was really no wealthy people. I mean, my mother bought me my first pair of football boots from a man in the evening press for 2 and 6 pence.
Nice.
And there were a brown pair of absolute garbage. But they were, I said that they hit the ball over the roof of the house with them. I said that I didn't. And the team next door had probably better boots. Now, my parents were professors, an engineer and a nurse, and they couldn't afford anything. So every summer, I worked on the road from the age of 14 with my dad. And those men who worked their arse off all their lives for a pittance. There was so much goodness in those fellas. They helped one another, they looked after me, even though I was the boss's son. They never, I really felt it was like an extended family. But I saw how hard working people had to work together to make a living, to put bread on the table and to try and get a better gig for their own children from up the line. And that really impacted big time on me. And it is something I think every medical student should be made to. They should be made work on the roads for 6 months as part of their medical training. Or they'll work in a cafe or a bar and learn how to deal with people, how to talk to people, how to listen to people. We don't do that in medicine at all. It's all technical, the 800 points and you're leaving, which means to get a leaving at that level, you can go football when you're 13 and start doing rhymes on Saturday and Sunday rather than playing football. And that's a huge education in this. But the medicine, kind of the commodification of medicine, where it's, you know, just computerized now and they hardly interact with the patients a lot of the time. It's a sad deterioration.
It's a really interesting point. Is that, it's a very obvious question, but why is that
Have
important?
You been to a doctor recently? Probably not, you're too young. But anyway, you go into a doctor's office in a consultancy now in a Bowman hospital, and the person is sitting in front of you, hi, blah, 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 and they barely look at you. They have to get it all down on the spreadsheet. So the hospital can bill, or whatever the business is, the private hospital bill for it. And I think the patients feel they're really not important anymore. Mm. I mean, the old GP who put his hand on your shoulder and helps you along are still an incredibly valuable resource, but there's very few of them around now.
Is that a societal thing?
It is a societal thing, but I think it's overemphasizing the leading cert in selecting medical students. If I was selecting a medical student now, I'd want them, I'd mother them as, you know, good looking, athletic, high achiever in sports. Oh yeah, and you pass the leading cert too, okay, we'll take you. Yeah. I mean, there are so many other elements that go into medicine. And you don't need the memory, which is essentially what the leading cert is and was, memorizing facts to be regurgitating. At the flick of a switch now, I can get the 500 computations or interactions between two drugs in 5 seconds. In my day, you had to memorize that.
Right.
And that's what the exam was about, turning that bullshit out. Now you can get that in 5 seconds. In fact, the patient knows that when you ask them, oh, take this and this, and says, well, I actually, you can't combine those two medications because blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, we have a good health service here in many aspects, but I think the humanities are missing it. I think the hospitals our patients are incarcerated in incarcerated is the right word. They're not fit for purpose. And we need to invest an awful lot in that area of help. But the people, I mean, 80% of our doctors now, I believe, are non-national. And we bitch about immigrants, or some people do. We will have no health service without our Filipino and Taiwanese nurses and our foreign doctors. None whatsoever. Yeah. Yeah. So we should be very grateful that we had them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's that period where I guess you're developing in terms of your career, in terms of your sports career, comes with this very interesting juncture where you go to France for a while, you become a hero in the town of La Rochelle. You also pick up a few shifts working in the hospital in La Rochelle as well.
I always loved French rugby. I mean, I don't know if it's before your time, but the French team of the 60s, they were brilliant. Pierre Villeprue, Jean Dessessin, and then going on for the Hamburg Barrow brothers, Frio Lux, unbelievable. They played rugby. Now, Iron rugby at the time was, you know, fighting spirit.
Sure.
And for all the 15 green surface heroes that slaughtered in Paris, you know what I mean? Yeah. But I wanted to be involved. That and Italian football.
Right.
If I had got the chance, I would have gone to Serie A. But I got the chance to go to France through Ollie Campbell. And he sorted me out with Ollie Sell.
How did you know Ollie?
I knew Ollie from my brother Michael, who played on the same Belvedere team that won the Lancer Hop in 1972.
Okay.
So Michael was a cheater on that team, not Ollie.
Not Ollie. Was he a better kicker than Ollie?
Well, at the time he scored nearly all the points in that Hop final.
Okay.
There. But Ollie was... Ollie was less pushy, I'd say, but he got to the front in the end.
Was it an opportunity that you absolutely jumped at, that you were a soul just raring to go and explore the world at that point?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it so happened that the president of the club at the time was a surgeon in the hospital that I was in. So I got a job as a sort of assistant to him, which meant he accommodated me for all the training and all the trips away and all that kind of stuff. So it was a holiday from medicine, and I still had my hand in technically because he took an interest in showing me how to do things. And it was another medicine too. France has a pretty good healthcare system, so I got to see that as well.
How many years did he stay in La Rochelle?
2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
Did you consider extending? Was it always time to come home?
I came home because I was halfway through a medical career. I was on the verge of starting a surgical training.
Okay.
And I wasn't prepared to invest in the French system and learn French properly. And
sure.
So I went home. If I wasn't a doctor, I would never have come home.
Okay.
I was very happy in France. I would have stayed there. Yeah.
Okay. What about what was going on in the world at that time? Were your antennae up with regards to social injustice around the world in terms of humanity, as you mentioned?
Not as much as it should be now, to be honest. I mean, from the time I was 7 or 8 years of age, my only ambition in life was to play football for Dublin.
Okay.
And I achieved that in Leven-Threaton School. I was on the Dublin senior team at 17. And it's been all downhill since in some ways. And I was so invested in that, you know. The Vietnam War, for instance, was raging at the time, and students were getting the crap out of them everywhere in the world. I didn't engage in that at all. I knew about it, but I was in my bubble, and I can see to some extent why foreign footballers aren't more active than the Palestinians, so on, as they are now, because they are, I believe, I'm quite unaware, I think, in a lot of cases of what's going on, because they just don't watch it, they don't listen to it. They're only interested in getting on the Dublin team, which now is a 7-day-a-week job.
Of course.
Yeah. So I became a little bit more aware when the first awareness I really had of it was Muhammad Ali shooting his mouth off about Vietnam and that kind of thing. And I didn't quite like it.
Right.
Believe it or not. Because I felt that he was being disrespectful to the soldiers in the field. You know, that bullshit that they did. That, I heard that somewhere and I was really
happy.
Yeah, from the USA. Yeah. But then I saw Tommy Jones and John Carlos. Tommy Jones, yeah. Tommy Smith, sorry, and John Powell at the 68 Mexico Olympics. And that lit a fire under me. And then we moved on to the 76 games with Alberto Juan Moreno and Stevenson. And they refusing $1 million contracts to go and play in the United States because they were committed to the revolution in Cuba. So I became a little bit more interested in that, but only in an academic sense.
Okay.
I then, when I was studying in I set up the Pancras program in Dublin, and I went to Madison, Wisconsin for 2 months. And then I went to Lyon in France for 1 month to see how they take the different techniques. And in Lyon, I met a fellow called Pedro Albalate, who was from Havana, and he was over doing much the same as myself. And I really liked the guy, and he was, you know, he was a very good-looking Latino, great dancer, great drinker, great man all around town, and everyone loved him, and he would have been a big success in France, but no, he was going back to bring this technique back to his people. So I said, I shouldn't touch this new Pedro, I'd love to come over and meet you. So we rose and then he invited me over. And I came over in 2000. Now that's a long time down the track, but anyway. And I arrived in his hospital, he thought he was dead. And that he was only 34 years of age. He had died on a medical mission in Ecuador. His plane, they were doing some medical mission in the forests of Ecuador. Small plane, brass land, airstrip. They missed the airstrip, crashed into the forest, and he was burned to death. Wow. So that kind of really gripped me, and I got buried in the human health system then, and the rest is history.
So you gained that curiosity, and you said to yourself, I need to go and visit the place?
Yeah. I did, and then I kind of got more and more involved in visiting it, and I saw the hardships impacted on their health system by the American blockade that precipitated the pro-Park protests in 1999, mm-hmm. And I've been involved with them since.
When was the first time you went to Cuba?
The first time was 1999.
Right, so in and around the Jubilee protests.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So it's a bit of time after the likes of Stevenson are doing their thing.
Oh, it was, yeah. It had percolated well into my system and germinated, yes.
What was the biggest takeaway that you took from Cuba as somebody with your background, as a sports person who also excels in medicine?
I think in Cuba, sport is for everyone. I mean, that's the mantra on the main stadium, Esportivo para todos. And every child, man, woman, and child, is involved in some sport, right up to their 80s. My mother-in-law now is 85, and she comes here for the summer and spends her winters now in Havana. And 3 times a week, in the corner of her block, there's a nice little park, and they have Tai Chi every morning for an hour, nice, with a professional trainer. So they're doing that. You walk around the streets, they're playing baseball. I mean, you hardly ever see a child playing into the streets here now, except their iPhones. And they're there playing there. And another thing that's very interesting in Cuba is that chess is a major sport.
Right.
On the back page of the newspaper, you have baseball, maybe basketball, chess, and then soccer is the inside of the back page. So the reports of local matches and Cuban doing international chess matches. Chess is a major sport in Cuba.
Do you ever get into chess yourself?
No.
No.
Too intellectual, and you have to think too far in advance for me.
you live in the moment a bit too much.
I do.
it's fascinating, because also on the other side of that is that you really learned a lot in terms of what Cuba managed to do with its resources in terms of medicine.
Absolutely. I got involved as well with the ELAM school, Escuela Latino Americana de Medicine. This was set up by the Cuban government in after Hurricane Mitch, I think it was 1989, Raul Castro donated to the Cuban state a military barracks 70 kilometers north of Havana. And they converted that into an international medical school. And they took students from all over the developing world, including the United States. And they have today graduated 10,000 doctors and sent them back to their indigenous countries. They provided the education, accommodation, books, and a small stipend of pocket money. Now, Cuba did that because they feel they are a lucky country, that they have resources, human resources, and they want to share them. And this is a country that is on the amazing list of countries that promote terrorism and are banned from nearly all external financial transactions now as a result. That was done by Trump last. I mean, they're the greatest bastion of peace in the world. And you look at the COVID epidemic, they were the first people to send a team to Northern Italy, when Northern Italy broke down there. The major earthquake in Pakistan, Cuba. The hurricane in Haiti, Cuba. The Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone, Cuba. America sends an army to protect U.S. interests, i.e. the diamond mines in Sierra Leone. So Cuba is a model country of how the world should live.
You met your wife in Cuba?
I did.
When was that?
That was 1999.
That was on your first trip to Cuba?
It was, yeah. And she was working in Austria at the time.
Okay.
I was married here at the time.
Right.
But I'm married to a very brilliant person who was a surgeon. But it's very hard for two surgeons to have a life together. I mean, mind you, the human there was a surgeon as well. But so I didn't learn any lessons. But it was an initial breakup with my first wife. She was as happy to be with me as I was. Probably a lot happier, in fact. But yeah, we hit it off pretty well. What more do you need to know?
it's an amazing romance, and it's one that I suppose. Did you get married like straight away thereafter? Did it take a couple of years?
No, 7 years.
7 years.
Yeah.
So were you back and over to Cuba
back
all the time?
Back and over and that kind of stuff. Yeah, and then she got a job here as a neurosurgeon.
Right.
And eventually we got married, and we had a boy who was a character. He was here one evening with his grandmother, and he was going on about what a great country Ireland was. And she got a bit pissed off and said, "Listen, sonny boy, you're 50% Cuban." And he said, "Grandma, or abuela, I'm not. I'm 100% Irish and 100% Cuban."
Great answer.
Unbelievable bloody answer. And it's quite true, you know. He has the best of both worlds and the worst of both worlds.
Well, did you ever consider settling down in Cuba?
I would, but my family is very important to me.
Right.
Here in Ireland. And my old Dublin team of the 70s. I have a lot of great friends there that I like seeing. But yes, I mean, Cuba, if Yami was still alive, we would have ended up in Cuba, I think. But, Cuba is an ideal place for older people. Because there's no loneliness, which is the bane of old people's lives here now in the so-called developed world. And there's no insecurity, because there's no crime in Cuba. No money, no crime. No social status, no crime. No social gap. The difference between the rich and the poor in Cuba is non-existent. And there's virtually no corruption as far as I can see. Mm-hmm. The government drives at the bus to work just like the ordinary punter.
Okay. What sort of woman was Yamile?
Well, she was a typical Latina, Caribbean. She was good-looking, vivacious, irreverent, fearless, And unfortunately, Sears was a tutor in the end. She drowned in Cuba. But she was a breath of life for me. She was really a wonderful human being. And she's with me every day. I mean, she's always around. Her spirit, her soul is here with me.
How do you remember her? How do you and allow yourself to remind yourself of her every day?
Well, this is a garden out there is in her memory. Her ashes are there behind you, just behind the wall there. We have photographs everywhere. But you know, all the little princes, the tapestries, for instance, are hers. That's kind of a memory of Cuba for her. But everything really, everything reminds me of her.
Is there happiness in that every day? Or is it
there
always?
There is, but you know, I walked a man around the garden where we used to walk with him, I walked with David in the past, and she's always there, and it isn't happy, no, it's not. It's sad that she's not there, because she was a lot younger than me. She was 7 years younger than me, and we sort of had a. No one looked after me. Yeah. Except Peril.
he's more than enough, but. It's all recent as well.
4 years. 4 years. We were on holidays in Cuba for the Christmas. The Emmy used to work in the hospital every year for a couple of months to maintain her licensing there. So David came back to himself. He was going to leave his third year. So we came back to his school. And the day we came back, that night I got a phone call to say she had died. So the next day we got flights back to Havana for the funeral. And it was hard.
Of course.
Yeah.
For her family, I presume you're in touch with them all the time?
Oh, grandma is here a lot. Right. You know, she's the only contact I have really with the family. Her dad is dead. Okay.
You mentioned there about the loneliness that can sometimes envelop elderly people in the country. When you lose somebody, that's obviously something that is of danger of happening. You have plenty of people around you here, though.
I'm lucky. I mean, there's an awful lot of people in this country now who's, you know, are on their own. And I could always tell when I was working in clinical medicine myself, I've always said, and in neurology rather than the transplant side of my job, it was a specialty for old men. I've always had the old man who was on his own. No matter how rich or how poor he was, the man without a woman in his life, you could spot him a mile away.
Really?
Yeah. And he could be wearing Gucci shoes and an Armani suit, and he'd still know there was no woman in his life. And he would come in rags, and you'd know there was some woman looking after this other fellow.
How can you tell?
No matter how, and you can see it, there's an intentness about a disorder. About
disorder, as opposed to an unhappiness?
As opposed to some folks are very happy that their wife isn't there anymore. But they're still not whole.
Yeah. Would one be able to tell that you're without a woman in your life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd say so very easily. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The last couple of weeks and months we've spoken to you in studio about the Palestinian protest, the huge amount of people that have shown up in the streets, you being a leader of the Irish Support for Palestine protest and movement. How does that make you feel that you're part of this massive collection of people? I guess I'm kind of hooking this on the back of the loneliness topic that you brought up there.
Right, but for starters, Irish Support for Palestine, Joanne McDonald is the founder of that and the main driver with Michael Darren-McCauley. I kind of have piggybacked onto it to a large extent. But for a start, it has started out small, but it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And most of my Dublin team have joined it. Most of the rugby lads, I mean, Tony Ward, Mitch Quinn, Donald Spring, have joined it. John Robbie has joined it. So we have got a very great group of fellows coming together now. And we meet on the Saturdays. And we have a group in Belfast now run by Michael Doherty, Dales for Palestine. We have a major meeting in Belfast 2 weeks ago. 50,000 people, 16 GA clubs. He got there. So we're gradually getting momentum. And I feel that voice is being heard by people in Dublin, because I see Ireland doing a little bit more now. I mean, the performance this morning, I haven't seen it yet, but by all accounts was spectacular at the International Court of Justice. They really laid it down as it was. But we want to see our government join South Africa and make a difference in the world. Make a difference. We have a colonial past. We were in the position for 800 years that Palestine has been in for the last 100 years. And if we can't empathize and have compassion for those people, I don't know what we're at. So I intend using my voice and my colleagues the same, and hopefully we can get the entire GAA, IRSU, FAI to promote a complete boycott of Israel from all sports. And that is what changed South Africa, and that's what will change Israel.
Have you noticed a shift over the last few months in terms of more support, in terms of more empathy?
Absolutely. I mean, the walk last Sunday in Dublin City was at least 100,000 people. And I assessed the size of the crowd by, was that crowd still Hope Park? That crowd went from the Garden of Remembrance over O'Connell Bridge at the start, and people joined it on the way. That's more than a full whole part in my perspective. So yes, it's a bigger and bigger, and I think the Irish government will get bolder and bolder when it sees that the people of Ireland are behind what South Africa has done and what the United States and Britain and the EU have been afraid to do.
Are you hopeful that the government will be bold enough?
I am modestly optimistic, but I can assure you, if they aren't, if they don't do what we want, they will pay for it in the European and general elections next year. They will pay through the teeth for it. Because we will not forget them abandoning women, children, and innocent people in that century-old absolute disgrace created by the British government for their own expediency in 1917 by Mr. Balfour.
When it came to the situation a couple of weeks ago with the Ireland basketball team and the fixture against Israel that was not boycotted, do you think that the noise around that, or at least the sign of protest around that, will dissuade further instances of Ireland playing Israel? For example, tomorrow the Ireland women's team are playing Israel in an under-17 football match, for example.
That match went ahead, I think, is an absolute disgrace. Upton Sinclair put it nicely about protests and about human rights. But he said, it's difficult to expect a man to see something when his salary depends on him not seeing it. It's all about money, the IOC, FIFA, UEFA, and the FAI, and probably the GAA too. Of all organizations, they were founded as an anti-colonial organization. They were founded to cherish the culture and uniqueness of a particular culture, and that they can roll in 100% behind protests and give it their blessing. I mean, the Dublin girls football team did it, and they have taken a lot of shit from official GA over.
The Dublin footballers have they?
They were threatened with fines and all sorts of things, yeah.
It's a really interesting point you make. It doesn't excuse UEFA or the FAI or any of that for their behaviour, but it maybe explains inaction or worse. The GAA are in a quite unique situation here,
where
they have the opportunity.
They're supposed to be amateur. And I think certainly the Dublin crowd are amateur. And I know there's some managers around the country being paid, but in general, the whole organisation and Dublin County Board run 120,000 football matches a year, all on a voluntary basis. Referees, the whole lot. They get a pot of money, but that's it. But I see what Vavasetti 30 has done. That should be happening in Hope Park. It should be happening in Portishead. It should be happening in Temple Stadium, where the whole stadium have Palestinian flags and they're singing a pro-Palestinian song.
And maybe it will, like the season's only getting up and going.
I hope it will.
So what would your message be to Dublin fans, to Cork fans, to Tipperary fans in those stadiums in particular?
We're slowly getting a movement there. We've called Dubs for Palestine. And we're trying to get the Dublin GA clubs and rugby clubs to hunt to the parades or the protest marches with banners of their club. Now, Balbriggan Rugby did it the last day, and Wood Council GA did it the last day. As I said, there were 16 clubs in the north of Ireland that did it. So it's beginning to get traction, it's beginning to get legs. And I hope it happens very quickly, because time is running out for the people of Palestine. I'm amazed that they have managed to survive till now. They have had 4 months now without fresh water, on very poor rations, no medicine, no medical care. If a cholera epidemic starts there, that 2 million people will be wiped off the face of the earth in a month. Because there is nowhere for them to sleep, there is no sanitation, the water drains will be contaminated, it will spread like wildfire. And it will well spread into Israel, which would be ironic if Palestine wiped Israel off the map with an epidemic of cholera, smallpox, and other born diseases. So there is such thing as too late, and I hope our government adds the way of Ireland to the South African case at The Hague.
What about the United States? We have close links as a country to the United States, and I only bring this up because you know what's coming over the next couple of weeks, and it's going to be on the agenda with regards to St. Patrick's Day.
The United States, according to Martin Luther King, and we hope Martin Luther King is in sense in your life, is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Ramsey Clark, the American attorney, former American Attorney General, the greatest crime of the post-war world has been American foreign policy. Harold Pinter, Nobel laureate, kiss my ass or I kick your head in. That's American foreign policy. The American US today is the pariah of all pariah states. It is an abomination. The US government was overthrown 50 years ago by corporate America. The puppets in Congress and the Senate enact the legislation that corporate America writes for them. And everywhere in the world we have the mantra of peace, democracy, and American interests in the region. Those three words are supposed to be synonymous, when actually American interests are usually anti-democratic and pro-war. So the US is a bastard case. It has lost its credibility to the entire world, apart from Western Europe, which is afraid of it. Britain, which is its puppet. And Ireland, which is sitting on the fence between trying to do the right thing and trying to be friendly with the United States. So it's a difficult position, but a real friend tells you when you're doing something wrong. And if Ireland wants to do a service to the United States, they tell that fool in the White House where he's gone wrong. And Biden has been pro-war. He was a Democratic saber-rattler, drum-beater for the Iraq War. The biggest drum-beater for that war. And his performance in the Israeli team is shocking. And I hope he survives to get to The Hague, because The Hague has no meaning until Tony Blair, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and this guy are in The Hague. Then it will have credibility. At the moment, it's only for Africans and Eastern Europeans.
What do you think the outcome will be when Ireland goes to the United States? Do you have hope that the boat will be rocked at least a little bit?
Not really. I saw an interview with Bernie Sanders last week, in which he said he has spoken to his best friend in Congress when they were together, Joe Biden, to try and convince him about Israel, and he was wasting his time. Bernie Sanders was wasting his time, and Bernie Sanders brings all the youth of America into the Democratic pen. So he would turn the wheels very quickly on Biden if he wanted to. He has no influence. And we think someone with a bowl of reeds has any influence there. Myself, leaving the Israeli thing out of the question, I was always embarrassed by this begging bowl of the United States. And the shamrock bearing thing does more for the American president than it does for Ireland. The 40 to 50 million Irish Americans voting in the presidential elections. And if you antagonize them by not having a bowl of shamrock in the White House, you're risking not getting elected. That's my view of that. I hate it. I think it's paddywhackery of the highest degree. It makes me sick, okay, to see Barack Obama centered down halfway down the country. I tell you, we have 100 years of independence. Well, we haven't really, but we've had kind of independence. We were able to vote at the United Nations pro-China. We were able to vote at the United Nations for peacekeeping forces in Africa, which stands on a lot of things at the United Nations. But this current generation of politicians are wasting that legacy. I think we have we are losing our credibility in the developing world. I mean, along with Cuba, Ireland was the only country that went to Africa to give rather than take. Cuba, Nelson Mandela would credit Cuba with ending apartheid. Not Mary Manning, Cuban army at Fuji Valley in 1989. It's the first time a white army in South Africa, and it was an army of South Africans and Israelis, were defeated on African soil by a local indigenous and Cuban black army. Our missionaries went to Africa. Now, a lot of them went promoting the British colonial powers as well, but a lot of them were very good people and did bring something maybe to Africa. But all the other countries just exploited them. And in Susan Sontag described the white race as the cancer of human history. And Western Europe has been an abomination for the world.
Is this something that when you think about and talk about, you're having conversations with your fellow Dublin teammates from back in the day. Obviously, obviously Michael Darmacauley, as you mentioned, is
certain pushing an open door there. But he told me all this stuff.
With regards to the players of your era, I presume you're having conversations with them, or are you about?
Well,
this?
You know that great three iron on the 15th is probably a higher priority for a lot. No, they're old men now, and. No, there are some that are very engaged, but the majority of them would, if you twist their hand, they'd come up for a protest, but it's not their raison d'etre anyway, that's for sure.
What will you talk about with them in Croke Park tomorrow, or Saturday evening, for example?
Oh, that great goal in 1977, you know what I mean? Or Bobby Doyle's backhanded pass to Denise Healy or something like that.
Yeah.
We automatically transport back into the 70s and we're all 21 and 22 years of age and instantly.
How does that make you feel when you reflect on those times in those conversations?
We lived in a bubble for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And in those days the football was round the clock, because if you got to the All-Ireland final and we got to 6 in a row, the league started 2 weeks later. And if you got to the final of the league, which you did for 5 years in a row, you had a week's break between that and the championship. So for 6-7 years, that team were on the ball non-stop. So in those days, we enjoyed the training. We didn't really enjoy, I didn't enjoy the matches as much as the camaraderie of the training sessions, which were serious at the time, but wouldn't hold a candle to what the lads do today.
Sure. You've been a part in what the lads do today, though, to be fair, David.
Yeah.
And I guess the obvious question to ask with regard to that is, did you know that it was going to turn out this way when Pat Gilroy rings you up and you're involved as a selector?
Well, I remember watching them in the 2009 All-Ireland quarter-final, when they were hammered by Kerry by 19 points or something. And I had my doubts. Pat, I don't know why he asked me to come join the team, to be honest about it now, but anyway, he invited me down, and I said I'd think about it, and I met a few lads, and I talked, and I decided I'd give it a go after meeting the team and watching them train. And I did it for purely selfish reasons. I wanted something to do with my spare time, and I saw that they had something. I wasn't going to rubber stamp another 19-point problem.
Nice.
And did I put them through a winter of training that going on to the 2010 season, and it was real-life stuff. I have never seen such suffering in my life. 5:30 in the morning on Ballymount Strand, every morning. And the week was capped on a Friday night trip to Inishkeen in the snow, the muck and the shit to play Monaghan. Now, Pat wanted commitment, and his mantra was based on kind of what Pat Riley with the LA Lakers had. He only wanted committed players as well. And when asked how he got committed players, he said, it's simple. I eliminate the uncommitted. By the end of those winter mornings and Friday evening sessions in his team, the fellows who were left there really believed in the halls. And he played Bernard Bowman in every one of those matches for every minute. Because Bernard was a little bit on the left side in terms of commitment.
Did he think he could break him?
Yeah.
He
wanted to see. And he Bernard threw up the test. Bernard played full forward in every one of those shitty matches.
Yeah.
And came through it. And ended up being probably one of the main players of that team and that they've had. And Stephen Thompson used to play as horror forward a lot of the time.
Mm.
But they were, I mean, I thought the pain went up there, the Western pain.
It's remarkable. It's even more remarkable, though, is that you were one of the first ones to call the five in a row when it happened. You did it in an interview in 2015 after they won the first of the six that it ultimately would turn out to be.
Yeah, but
you knew.
I knew they had something special. They were the right age. They had lost in All Ireland, you know, the semi final against Cork in 2010. That was a heartbreak loss. I mean, they were a much better team than Cork, as they subsequently proved. And they were robbed. I mean, a penalty on the day that any other referee in the country would have given a free out, they were robbed. That was the nation of that team. If they had won their All Ireland that year, they probably, possibly would have disappeared. But having lost that and then come back and won it in the conditions they won it, I said, this is a special crowd, and they're only coming. So, five in a row might have been a bit ambitious, but for I thought, why not? If you win next year, there's only three more to go, yeah?
That's it, and so approved. Can I ask you, David, just before we wrap up, how's your health at the moment?
Well, my health isn't bad. I've survived a lot of cancer operations, and I'm left as a kind of a bit of a cripple as a result. I can't eat at all. So I haven't had a meal in nearly 5 years now.
Right.
I live on this diet. And I don't speak very well, as you can see. It's not that easy to understand what I'm saying a lot of the time, particularly if I'm mad. So it probably would take me a friend. But my health is okay. I mean, I'm not on any medication.
Right.
So that's probably a good thing.
And day to day, you're feeling good. You're obviously feeling with plenty of energy, or does the diet?
Yeah, I've plenty of energy. I bring a man for a walk every number of times a day. He keeps me going.
Yeah.
And then I drum David, kind of keeping up to date from the latest in the rap music scene and that kind of stuff. So.
And what are you listening to? Who's your favourite rapper?
I'm not sure. The DJ G or whatever.
Right. With regards to some of the operations that you've had to go through, the way you're talking, were some of them high risk in terms of surviving them, or what was it? What have you gone through?
Well, it's an interesting story. When I got this cancer, it was operated in Bowman Hospital by Michael Watts, and he saved my life. Right. But he wasn't able to remove the entire tumor because it was pressing on my optic nerve, the nerve to their eye. And being a surgeon, that would jeopardize your career. So I had to have a special form of radiation therapy. So I went to three centers to find out which was the best one. I went to London, Paris, and Toronto. I went to London, and I met a Harley Street asshole. Charged $1,500 for a 15-minute consultation. He gave me a lousy prognosis, a 40% survival rate, and told me the way I think about it. Myself and Yami then went off to Paris, and we met an even bigger asshole in France, head of the biggest hospital with the biggest reputation in the world for this kind of tumor. He knew I was a colleague, he was arrogant, he spent about 5 minutes with me, and he said, "Look, I haven't a lot of time now, but this is simple. We remove your eye. Okay? Remove your eye. That's the safest thing to do." So I said, "Well, for him." So then we went to Toronto, and that was made for me. The whole department was Irish.
Right.
And I knew them. So we stayed with Toronto.
Okay.
And I had radiation and chemotherapy that went on for 3 months, and that was hard enough for them now. And it cured the cancer, but it left me with other cancers, secondary cancers. It left me with no speech, it left me with no taste, it left me with no ability to do a lot of things I used to do. So my cancer was cured, but I inherited a whole lot of treatment-related diseases.
Did you know that was going to be the case before?
I did, but I wanted to stay working, so I didn't want my eyes taken out.
The eyesight's an important thing.
It is, but having come up the other side of this now, I had seven subsequent operations, the French lab was right.
The French lab was right?
Yeah. I should have had my eyes taken out.
Right.
And I would be enjoying a nice pizza on a Friday evening, and I wouldn't be able to do my job reasonably well too. But the whole concept of enunciating an eye was just abhorrent to me.
I can't blame you. You need the peripheral vision, though, to be able to see Conor Callaghan catch a big high ball on the edge of the square underneath the hill. So
well,
you do
no,
have to enjoy that.
The peripheral vision was to see the eye and Paul Jones save from the left with a haymaker from left field.
It's a remarkable. I've already taken up an hour and a half of your time. Oh no, sorry, just over an hour, I should say, of your time. You've been so generous with your time, I guess, just as a final.
I'm never tired talking about myself. So.
But I'm not never tired listening to you. I must say, David, it's you're a remarkable man with a remarkable story. And I apologize for the vagueness of this last question. And you can take this question up any way you want or any of the topics we discussed. And I just want to ask you: Are you optimistic in general?
I'm optimistic for the afterlife, up to a point. I've lived my life along the lines of Albert Camus. I prefer to live my life believing there is a God, dying and finding out there isn't, than living my life believing there isn't a God, dying and finding out there is. A bit cynical. In terms of the future, I'd be very worried for what my young fellow, who is now 21, is going to see over the next 30 years. I would be very worried that corporate world, the 0.1% who own everything in the world and have no concept of humanity, will drive us over the edge towards a war of extinction. That's climate change. Are the two great worries.
Listen, David, thank you so much for welcoming me into your home. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. I apologize to Perro over here for keeping you from him for so long and for rudely ignoring him as well for the last hour. But no, I really appreciate your honesty as always, David, and just very, very best of luck with everything.
Pleasure. It's lovely to have a cherry man in the house.